From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is off today, and on this edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actor George Hearn. He starred in Broadway productions of Sweeney Todd and La Cage aux Folles, and now has the lead in a new theatrical production of Chaim Potok's novel, The Chosen. Also today, I talk with actor Josh Mostel. He's the son of the late Zero Mostel, who's starring in a play on Broadway called The Boys Next Door. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews A Very Special Christmas, featuring holiday songs performed by Bruce Springsteen, U2, and Run DMC. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Last Emperor, Bernardo Bertolucci's epic view of the fall of the Chinese monarchy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is George Hearn. He first came to national attention as the demon barber of Fleet Street in a production of Sweeney Todd, which was shown on cable television. He had played that role on Broadway and on tour as a replacement for the show's original star, Len Cariou. George Hearn became a musical star in his own right with his portrayal of the lovable transvestite Albin, also known as Zaza, in the Broadway production of La Cage aux Folles. His performance earned him the 1984 Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical. Earlier in his career, he had received Tony Award nominations for his role as a German freedom fighter in Lillian Hellman's play Watch on the Rhine, as well as his work in the short-lived musical A Doll's Life. He appeared as Ben in the concert version of Stephen Sondheim's Follies. George Hearn is in New York now, preparing to open in a musical based on Chaim Potok's The Chosen. George Hearn, I know the show is in previews now, and you're working very hard, and I really can't tell you how pleased I am that you're taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Leanne.
I'd like to start with a little piece of music to give everyone an idea of what your voice really sounds like. And it's an obscure little piece. It's from a show where Stephen Sondheim wrote the music, but the lyrics to the song that we're going to hear, Weep No More, were actually written by Shakespeare. Do you have anything you'd like to say about that before we get started? It was a concert that you had done of Sondheim's music from which this record is taken.
Yes, and about my favorite record I've ever been on. It was a wonderful experience. That show originally was done, you know, in the swimming pool at Yale. It was the Frogs. And anything of Stevens, of course, is wonderful. And the lyrics weren't bad by Shakespeare either. It was a great thrill, that concert. And a wonderful group of people doing some of the unusual songs, you know, that hadn't been done in a while. And I think I'm proudest of that record of the few that I've done.
Come to dust.
That's Fear No More from the show The Frogs, sung by my guest, George Hearn. With lyrics by Shakespeare, it's almost an appropriate place to start talking to you, because before you were known as a musical actor, you had actually done something on the order of 13 productions in the New York Shakespeare Festival, playing all the classic roles.
Yes, I'd done a lot of Shakespeare. I think I've done 33 different productions of 22 of the plays, and a lot of them for Joe Papp at the Public and in the Park in the summers, and the Stratford, Connecticut Festival, and at Princeton's MacArthur. I miss it a little.
Well, were you aiming for it to be a classical actor when you started your career?
Well, I was aiming for anybody who'd give me a job, I guess, like many another. I like doing language plays, and I love doing Shakespeare. So it just happened that I did a lot of it consecutively. And I think one should go back to it as often as possible. It's the best kind of work you can do, I think.
Well, that training seems to have helped you bring such a richness of interpretation in that particular song. It's not that easy to sing Shakespeare. It's like opera almost.
Yes, and that piece is like a German art song almost. It's sustained complexities, and it's like singing Brahms or Hugo Wolf. Stephen's incredible, isn't he? What a speaking of span. Yes, he's wonderful.
Really, a marvelous. Were you trained as an opera singer?
I studied opera at Aspen, Colorado. I studied several years with Mac Harrell, who was a wonderful baritone, wonderful teacher. And I did a few operas, Ariadne off Naxos, and in St. Louis when I was at Washington University. So I did some singing, and I did some concert singing. But I preferred the acting world. To me, it was liberating in a way that the classical music world wasn't.
How long did it take before, say, Stephen Sondheim knew that you could sing well enough to appear in Sweeney Todd, say?
Well, to my knowledge, Stephen may have seen me do I Remember Mama with Lee Volman, that Richard Rodgers' 40th and last musical. He may have seen that. I don't know where Stephen first heard me sing enough to... I was offered that job by Stephen and Hal, and then they said... afterwards, they said, would you mind coming up about a month later and singing one of these pieces for us? And I said to my agent, I said, I thought I had the job. He said, well, you do have the job. And I said, but if I don't sing it very well, I probably don't, do I? He said, well, that's probably the case. So I went and sang Epiphany, the song at the end of Act One of Sweeney, and it was apparently sufficient that they were sufficiently good that they let me do it.
Do you want to know how frustrating it is to not be able to play a recording of you singing from Sweeney Todd?
That's right. There isn't any, is it?
No.
My good friend Len doing it. Len was dynamite. I saw him do it toward the end of the run that he did the year. Yeah, he was wonderful.
You had mentioned in an interview that I had heard earlier, about eight years ago. Apparently, Dorothy Loudon, who replaced Angela Lansbury in Sweeney Todd when you replaced Len Carew, said that there should be a Tony Award for most difficult act to follow.
Yes, they were a difficult act to follow. And I remember that first night, Dorothy and I would pass in the dark behind the set, and she'd say, "Are we getting away with this? Are we getting away with this?" And then by the end of it, we were ready to weep. We looked up at the marquee the first day after we rehearsed, and the names were changed. She said, "Oh Lord, we've got to do it now. Our names are on the marquee." But I was glad to do it. And she was a joy to work with.
Yeah, she's a lovely lady.
Very.
You were able to be recognized then because of your work in Sweeney Todd, simply because it was taped for distribution on cable television. And if I'm not mistaken, it was one of the very first musicals to actually be done. It was at a time when cable was really starting to come in to its own. That must have been very grueling for you, because I understand it was done in 4 days.
Yes, and while we were performing at night, we'd get up there at 6 o'clock in the morning and work all day taping it. And then we had two shows on Wednesday and two on Saturday. So we had an 8-show week during which we filmed all the time. It was absolutely exhausting. But, Lord, it was worth it, because Terry Hughes, the director, we all won Emmys for it eventually, you know, several years later. And I think he did a wonderful... I think it was in some ways better than the staged version, in that it was... The camera directed the eye more, you know, to because the piece was rather expansive, you know, or large, the big bridges and all. Mm. And the camera could select more carefully, and I thought they did an awfully good job of it.
And yet you never lost the sense that you were, as a viewer, part of a theatrical experience, an audience. It didn't sort of get distilled into a television experience. It was a very powerful theatrical experience, especially when we could see your horrifying face close up, you know.
It was great therapy.
Really?
It was wonderful to do that. I had a wonderful time. Yes, I agree with you. I think that that Terry Hughes then would bring the camera out at the end of the acts and at the end of certain pieces so that to remind us that it was a theatrical piece. And I think he set the benchmark for years to come on filming musical theater.
It is an opera. It's a chamber opera, Sweeney Todd. It's now included in the repertory of New York City Opera. And you are very vocal about, when people say this isn't an opera or, you know, musicals are not operas, you believe that they are.
Well, I dislike categorizing so rigidly. It's unnecessary. I think one writes what one can write. And if you're Mozart, you write Don Giovanni, and if you're Stephen Sondheim, you write this. They're musical theater, both of them. I mean, if you want to say, well, the opera makes larger demands on the voice, it's not always true. I mean, Sweeney's harder to sing than, say, Papageno is in Magic Flute. And if you want to say, I just find the criterion difficult to pin down and unnecessary to pin down. And I'm really pleased that Sweeney is taken rather seriously in the opera repertoire. It does have acting demands that are larger, I think, than opera has gotten used to accepting. And that's one reason that I dislike. I don't dislike. I can't participate in the opera world much because I wish that the acting values were respected more. And I know there are some magnificent opera actors, of course. But if you can have them all, if everything can be present, that's the ideal.
That's the ideal. My guest is George Hearn, who in 1984 won the Tony Award for his portrayal of Zaza in La Cage aux Folles. And I have a little piece of music, naturally, to play from that particular show. And it's called A Little More Mascara.
When life is a real bitch again, and my old sense of humor has up and gone, it's time for the big switch again. I put a little more mascara on. When I count my crow's feet again and tire of this perpetual marathon, I put down the John seat again and put a little more mascara on. And everything's sparkle dust, bugle beads, ostrich plumes. When it's a beaded lash that you look through, 'cause when I feel glamorous, elegant, beautiful, the world that I'm looking at's beautiful too. When my little road has a few bumps again and I need something level to lean upon, I put on my sling pumps again and wham! This ugly duckling is a swan. So when my spirits start to sag, I hustle out my highest drag and put a little more mascara on. And everything's ankle straps, marabou, shalimar. It's worth sucking in my gut and girdling my rear, 'cause everything's ravishing, sensual, fabulous, when Alban is tucked away and Zaza is here. When everything slides down the old tubes again, and when my self-esteem has begun to drift. I strap on my fake boobs again and literally give myself a lift. So when it's cold and when it's bleak, I simply rouge the other cheek, for I can face another day in slipper satin lingerie. To make depression disappear, I screw some rhinestones on my ear and put my brooches and tiara and a little more mascara on. Ankle strap, marabou on, ravishing on.
From the Broadway musical La Cage aux Folles, starring my guest George Hearn. What a wonderful song that is.
Yes. It's pretty silly, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You can sit here and listen to it, and it goes on. It's about 4 minutes long. But for people who haven't seen La Cage aux Folles, they don't realize that you have to get completely dressed during the length of that song and transform yourself into Zaza.
What I said about Sweeney, about being good, great therapy, that was even more so about this. It was great fun, and it makes all my opinions sound very stiff-necked now. It's relaxing and comfortable. I loved it. I had a wonderful time.
Did you have to work hard on the timing of that particular number to make sure that you had the bugle beads and the marabou and the shalimar and the ankle straps? And
oh, very hard. And it didn't always work, but mostly it worked. For 3 years I did it. I did 2 years on Broadway and then a year in London. And we didn't miss it too many times. But it was. Women would come up and say, it looks to me like you put on eyelashes during that song. I said, I do. They said, no, you don't. No, you don't. I said, yes, I do. But sometimes they were horizontal to my eyes, and sometimes they were vertical, but you couldn't tell at that distance. It was fun.
Didn't you have any qualms about playing a transvestite?
Oh, yes, I did. I went through a lot about it. When I felt very macho, I'd say, well, I'm not going to do that. And then nice friends of mine, Angela among them, and Colleen Dewhurst, and friends would say, don't be silly. You're secure enough about that, and go and have a great time. It's going to be one of the wonderful roles you'll ever play, and I'm glad I did. Mm. But there were times when it was I had many misgivings about it. Not about playing homosexual and not about even playing a transvestite. But that's not how, as I said, my wife said to me in London, she said, I think you're a little depressed about doing the show. I said, when I was a kid, I got into the show because I wanted into the theater. I wanted to be John Wayne. And the girls wanted to be Elizabeth Taylor. You wanted to enhance your own image of yourself. I said, this is not the image I had of myself as a child. And it isn't. But I did have great fun with it.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a little bit more about your role as Zaza in La Cage aux Folles, but we're going to take just a short break, and we'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is actor George Hearn. His career on Broadway has included the roles of the murderous barber, Sweeney Todd, and the flamboyant drag queen, Alban, in La Cage aux Folles. He is now starring as the strict Hasidic Jewish father in an off-Broadway production of The Chosen. Getting back to Alban just a little bit, it's interesting. You said you grew up wanting to be John Wayne, and there's this whole scene in the movie where you have to learn to butter your bread like Wayne. And did you have to unlearn some sort of unconsciously masculine postures? Did you have to really train to do that right so that Alban didn't turn into caricature?
Yes, somewhat. It was a line we wanted to draw very carefully. We didn't want to make him super swish because the audience wanted a large audience to identify with him. And I think it would have been a wrong direction anyway. I think Jerry Herman and Arthur Lawrence's taste was wonderful in doing that. Yes, I did. We accumulate gestures and postures, I think, through our lives that we call ourselves, and they aren't always ourselves. And I had to erase some of those. Slightly macho. I don't think that I am a very macho person anyway, but I still had to watch some things. And it's amazing what a turn of the head or a turn of the wrist, in this case, can do. And it was good. It was fun.
Isn't there a temptation, too, that turn of the wrist could kind of signal the audience, like, look, I'm married, I'm not gay, you know, I'm playing a character up here.
Yes, and I think, in fact, some people said that was so, the performance. I'm not sure. I felt as comfortable as I could, you know, and I went as far as I could, still feeling comfortable. I hope I didn't signal to the audience indirectly that, no, I'm actually not a transvestite. I think that would have been betraying the part, and I didn't intend to do that, but some people would say, you could have gone a little further with that, you know, but that was where I was comfortable with it, and apparently it worked enough for the show.
You've had to play opposite different Georges. I mean, the beauty of this particular story is they're an old married couple. They've been together for years. They're very familiar with one another. But you had to play it opposite different actors. I did not have the pleasure of seeing you with Jean Barry, but I did see you with Van Johnson and in London with Dennis Quiley. And did you find with playing with different actors in that role, you found different values in the relationship that you could draw on?
Oh, very much, yes. It changes everything, a different actor in a part that you depend on that much, you know, that particularly the humor and the timing of jokes and scenes. Yes, it was a tremendous experience. I don't think if I had to, I could list everybody I played it with over those 3 years. But Dennis Quiley, who did it in London, was a great joy. And of course, Jean and Van and Keith Michelle played. It was a wonderful group of men. But each one was very different, yes.
Did you have any idea that I Am What I Am would become such an anthem?
No, I don't even think that when we started, I don't even think Jerry or Arthur or any of us knew the size the piece was going to become. To some extent, we were aware of that, but it got to be, at that moment in theater history or in American history or something, it was as if the world was ready for exactly that and wanted that statement in some way. And, of course, the temperature has changed enormously since then. Mm. But I didn't know that it would be taken quite the way it was, and I'm proud that it was.
Well, just your delivery of that particular song, it was a little bit like Ethel Merman, you know, at the end of the first act. But you didn't move. You just let those words... I get goosebumps every time I listen to it still, because I can see your face while you were singing it, totally rigid and totally letting the audience in on the pain that Albin was feeling at having his identity and his whole self-esteem being attacked by... this boy that he's raised.
Well, it's a wonderful song. A friend of mine said that a lady said that her husband wept at the end. He was a singer and he was retired now. And she said, wasn't it beautiful? He said, yes, I wish somebody had written a song like that for me. He was crying for that. Then once Jerry told me, he said, George, he said, don't get so overwrought. It's not the end of the world. It's just about being homosexual. So we had a lot of fun with it. It was great.
My guest is George Hearn, who is currently preparing to open in a musical based on the Chaim Potok book, The Chosen. Could you briefly just describe for us the character and in the play that you're now working on?
Well, Reb Saunders is a Hasidic rabbi living in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn with his family. That's about two families, a Reformed Jewish family and a Hasidic family, and the two boys, two sons growing up, at the same age in school, meeting, and the friendship develops and has difficulties, and finally is saved across borders that are almost Romeo and Juliet like, and the whole play, it seems to me, becomes a very important play in that it's about how do we respect each other and have friendship across when you don't believe in the same things. Mm-hmm. When, in fact, when you disagree quite violently, and it certainly is what the world has to learn. It might be learning right now, hopefully, mm-hmm. With Gorbachev and Reagan, one would hope. The thing is that if people have strong convictions, how do you sustain friendship and love and regard? And I think this play deals very heavily in that and very beautifully in it. Getting to know Chaim has been one of the great pleasures of my life. He's a wonderful man. And I think we're hunting big game with the show.
Yeah. Are you Jewish?
No. No, but I'm Irish, and that's just about the same thing.
Yeah, well, the passion, yes, absolutely, the passion, and the fact that this whole, what you call a Romeo and Juliet story, which is a perfect way to describe it, revolves around the sort of the strictness of the father, who doesn't even speak to his son, and the music is almost at times religious in nature, not to make it sound more lofty, but it's religious. Did you go into temple and sort of listen to a cantor?
I did sing in a Reform synagogue in Memphis, Tennessee, where I was a few times. And I'm familiar with the musical style a lot. I love it, by the way. We also went to Williamsburg one evening and spent about 4 or 5 hours there in a synagogue. And it was stunning. It was for me, who is somewhat skeptical of all religions and a sort of homogenized American, to see a culture as loving and intense, everyone giving the energy back to the community for hours and hours, the children. It was very beautiful and very shocking. And in fact, I don't know anything in the Christian world that quite equals the communal intensity, spirituality of what I saw there. And it, in a sense, it's changed my life.
It has.
One of the great pleasures of being an actor, I think, is getting into the skin of a character who may not believe the same things that you do, but you begin to empathize, and then you begin to realize your opinions perhaps don't mean as much as you thought they always did, and that maybe you should change them every now and then. And I've been quite shaken up by this, by getting to know these people, even to the extent that I do, which isn't profoundly, but I hope will be.
You're completely believable in the role of a Hasidic rabbi.
Thank you.
And I saw the show in previews. The show's been going through a lot of changes. There have been changes in characters, changes in directors, back and forth. But in spite of all of that, in spite of scenery moving and light cues that don't work and all this, you managed to give a performance that is still 250%.
Thank you.
I have to wonder where that comes from, briefly, from training or from you as a person or from someone that inspired you?
Well, I think there are times when we're all, with our work, we're all at sea. Sometimes I think if the piece, if you got into it for the right reasons, and in this case, I love this. I mean, if you remember the film, Rod Steiger's performance, the entire film was beautiful. The novel's even larger to me, and my love of the material was what got me involved in it. And I wouldn't betray that for anything. I enjoy that. And that's the joy of being an actor.
George Hearn, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Lynn.
My guest has been George Hearn. He is now starring in the off-Broadway production of Chaim Potok's The Chosen at the Second Avenue Theater in New York City. The play is now in previews and is scheduled to open on January 7th. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Sally Kirkland. She's now appearing in her first starring role in the film Anna. She began her acting career at the Actors Studio in the early 60s with Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Shelley Winters. So I hope you can join us.
It's my world that I want to have a little pride in. My world, and it's not a place I have to hide in. Life's not worth a damn till you can say, hey world, I am what I am. I am what I am. I don't want praise. I don't want pity.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is taking the day off. Coming up, actor Josh Mostel. He can be seen in supporting roles in the movies Radio Days and Matewan, and is now starring in a Broadway show called The Boys Next Door. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album A Very Special Christmas, featuring holiday songs from Madonna, The Pretenders, Run DMC, and others. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bernardo Bertolucci's new movie, The Last Emperor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, this news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Wilman in Washington. President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev held their final meeting of the Washington summit today. The Soviet leader left the White House this afternoon, saying some headway was made during the talks. Details from NPR's Brian Naylor.
The two leaders met for about 2 hours in their final session. They emerged from the White House into a steady rain, and standing under umbrellas, they read formal departure statements. The president said the summit was a clear success, saying while the two leaders expressed different points of view on issues such as human rights and regional conflicts, a door has been opened that will stay open. Mr. Gorbachev agreed on that point, and that there was movement toward limits on long-range missiles.
In our talks with President Ronald Reagan, some headway has been made on the central issue of that process, achieving substantial reductions of strategic offensive arms, which are the most potent weapons in the world.
The two leaders were not able to finalize any agreements during the summit, however, except for the medium-range missile ban. However, in the words of the General Secretary, they have been able to form a kind of agenda for future talks. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The U.S. foreign trade deficit soared to a record $17.6 billion in October, more than 25% above the September imbalance. Economist Larry Chimerine of Wharton Econometrics says he's concerned about today's news.
I don't think anyone should overreact right now, but nonetheless, I think it's fair to say that, this trade problem is a deep-rooted problem. It reflects a change in our competitive position in world markets. It's going to take years and years to overcome, and we're making some progress when you adjust the numbers for inflation, but when you don't adjust them, we're making no progress at all.
The trade deficit report sent shockwaves through world currency markets, pushing the dollar down to record lows in frantic trading. A former consultant to Lyndon LaRouche was found guilty today in Boston of conspiracy charges. A federal grand jury deliberated for 3 hours over 2 days before returning the verdict in the case against Roy Frankhauser. Frankhauser was convicted of conspiring to cover up millions of dollars in alleged credit card and loan fraud by LaRouche's 1984 presidential campaign. The prosecution in Michael Deaver's perjury trial told the jury today that Deaver used his friendship with President Reagan to make big money for himself, then drew on his public relations skills to cover it up. Independent counsel Whitney North Seymour portrayed the former White House aide as a sly manipulator of power who made top-level government contacts on behalf of high-paying clients of his consulting firm. Late yesterday, the judge in the case ruled that Deaver cannot use alcoholism as defense because only hearsay evidence was presented. In today's issue of Science magazine, doctors from Italy say they've discovered a new cancer-causing virus. NPR's Lori Garrett has more.
Doctors at the University of Rome say they have treated 8 middle-aged Italian men for very unusual types of blood system cancers. All the patients were family men with no known special health risk factors in their lives. The doctors isolated a new virus from the blood of these men. They've dubbed it HTLV-5, saying it belongs in the same family, the HTLV family, as the AIDS virus. The new virus seems to attack the same cells the AIDS virus attacks, so-called T lymphocytes, or white blood cells. And one of the wives of these 8 patients is infected. Although she is well, doctors believe she got the virus through sexual intercourse with her husband. 2 other cancer viruses in the HTLV family, in addition to the AIDS virus, are sexually transmissible. So the doctors conclude they have discovered a 4th sexually transmitted cancer virus that attacks the human immune system. In New York, I'm Lori Garrett.
After three straight days of gains, stock prices turned sharply lower today on Wall Street. This is NPR. I'm Dale Wilman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has a review of a new Christmas song album featuring some of rock music's most popular artists. In the spirit of the holiday, proceeds from the record are being donated to the Special Olympics. Here's an old tune you may remember, done on this album a little differently.
It often seems as if rock and roll is too disrespectful to have much of a heart, but Christmas must bring out the best in people. 20 years ago, for example, producer Phil Spector released Phil Spector's Christmas Album. This remains a masterpiece of pop art, in which girl groups like the Ronettes and the Crystals reinterpret Christmas carols against the dramatic background of Spector's thundering wall of sound. Now comes the best Christmas rock since Phil Spector. A record called A Very Special Christmas has gathered together 15 holiday songs by as many top music acts, including Madonna, Bruce Springsteen, Run-DMC, The Pretenders, and the man you just heard, John Cougar Mellencamp croaking through I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus. The best thing about A Very Special Christmas is that it's not just a superstar goof, a charity record cut on the run. The people involved seem to have put some thought into their selections, and many of the performances can stand with the best work these acts have done. For example, Chrissy Hynde, lead singer for The Pretenders, has somehow managed to transform Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas into a soulful blues number.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on,
most of the 15 songs on A Very Special Christmas are fresh versions of familiar tunes. The Pointer Sisters singing Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Stevie Nicks warbling Silent Night, Bob Seger providing a new beat for the little drummer boy. But the rap music act Run-DMC has composed its own holiday ode, one with an inner-city edge. It's a memory of the rapper's old neighborhood in Queens, New York, called Christmas in Hollis.
Christmas trees.
Judged by strict critical standards, A Very Special Christmas isn't perfect. Bryan Adams' version of Chuck Berry's Run, Rudolph, Run is shallow compared to the original. And, as is her tendency, Whitney Houston's Do You Hear What I Hear is pretty without much passion. But a few bum cuts can't spoil the spirit of this collection, which is also spiked with a sharp wit. Madonna may be floundering as a movie star, but her musical instincts are still confident. She's taken Eartha Kitt's rather obscure 1953 novelty tune, Santa Baby, and turned it into that rarest of all things, a sexy Christmas song.
Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa baby, an outer space convertible to light blue. For you, dear Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight. Think of all the fun I've missed. Think of all the fellas that I haven't kissed. Next year I could be oh so good if you'll check off my Christmas list. Biddle, biddle, Santa honey, I want a yacht, and really that's not a lot. I've been an angel all year, Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight.
You can still buy that Phil Spector Christmas album I mentioned earlier. This year it's even been reissued on compact disc, which only enhances its magnificent sound. But if you're searching for new holiday pop, A Very Special Christmas is the album to make you wiggle while you wrap presents.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Josh Mostel. You may remember him for his role as Uncle Abe, the funny man with the fish, in Woody Allen's film Radio Days. If not, you can catch a glimpse of him in Oliver Stone's new movie, Wall Street, which opens across the country this week. Josh Mostel is currently appearing at the Lambs Theater in New York in a play by Tom Griffin called The Boys Next Door. It's about four mentally handicapped men living in an experimental outpatient community. Josh Mostel plays one of the men, Norman Bolanski. As Norman, Josh Mostel is warm, touching, and very, very funny. And when we spoke at NPR's New York Bureau, he told me that comedy comes naturally to him.
I like it when people laugh. I mean, in real life, I like to make jokes. I like it when my wife laughs. I like it when my friends laugh. I usually, look for the cheap laugh wherever I go. It's just kind of the way I was brought up.
Do you consider yourself a type? Do you think people in the industry consider you, Josh Mostel, kind of a type? The type that rapidly comes to mind is the funny fat man.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I'd like to play everything. I've had kind of variety. The industry does tend to... There's a lot of stuff out there. I'd like to try it all. I hope I'm not too typed. I mean, I guess I am by my very appearance and age, but...
You mentioned earlier the environment in which you grew up,
yes,
that sort of led you into comedy. Your father was Zero Mostel, very funny man.
Yes.
What was it like growing up in your household? Your mother was a Rockette. It was a show business family.
Sure. Yeah. What was it like growing up? I don't know. I went to school. It was like growing up everywhere. I mean, my parents were kind of extroverts, opinionated, loud, funny, raucous, not too conventional. I would say it was a lot of fun growing up. I mean, we're a fun-loving group. My parents were, and my brother is, mm-hmm, and I am.
Did you find yourself sort of naturally gravitating toward the business?
I naturally gravitated away from the business.
Really?
Yeah, I wanted to be a composer, and I went to college with the idea in mind, but it became clear that composing maybe didn't want me. Music was... I play instruments, and I have a fairly good ear, but I think as a professional, I don't think I could have cut the mustard.
Did your training, once you decided to go into the acting profession, help enhance that natural desire you had to make people laugh?
I think so. Part of the thing about training is that you just do it, so you automatically get more experience. You know, I wasn't getting jobs. And for a few months, I had the great jobs. I would do Chekhov. I would do Richard III. I would do lots of things.
Did you find the name Mostel, the fact that you're Zero Mostel's son, work for you in any way? Or did it work against you when you were trying to make your own name in the business?
It can work for you and against you. It's sort of irrelevant. I don't think when I direct sometimes too. If the son of a famous person walks in, I'm apt to say how interesting, but I'm not apt to give the person the job. You know, you want to give the job to the person that you think will make you look good, or the person that can really do the job best. You know, it's sort of irrelevant ultimately.
I just imagine you as an actor doing similar kinds of parts, that funny
Batman, I wouldn't mind.
You know?
Well, I don't know. Zero's had some great parts. Yeah. I mean, Zero, you know, Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof is a great part. Rhinoceros was a great part. Ulysses in Nighttown. I mean, these are major, big parts on Broadway. A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. I don't have any kind of... parts like that. I probably have done more movies than he's done. Mm. But
he's known, I mean, the movies, I think he's known perhaps best in The Producers,
yeah.
Which is that,
yeah.
Again, that funny sort of fat man type. When you were offered this role in The Boys Next Door, which is a play about four men living together, two are mentally retarded, two are schizophrenic, it's part of an experimental outpatient program mainstreaming people into society. You were offered the role of Norman Bielanski. Could you describe Norman Bielanski just for us briefly?
Norman's retarded. He's an extrovert. He's very interested in donuts and just gets overwhelmed by things. And I have a hard time verbalizing him, but he's Norman. I like Norman. I think he's a hell of a guy. He's fun. He's not very bright, but he's sincere. He's interested. And he's very funny, I hope. And he's touching it sometimes too, I would think.
There's a moment at the end of the first act where Sheila and Norman are dancing at a community dance, and where their stunted bodies and their stunted minds all of a sudden disappear, and Norman and Sheila turn into Fred and Ginger. And it conveys the idea that perhaps these mentally handicapped people we see on the subway or pass by in the streets or try to move to the next seat have these inner lives that we will never, ever understand.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the point of the scene. The idea that they're, whatever they appear like on the outside, inside, they're just as we are. I mean, they have the same feelings. They have the same desire to be loved that we all do. You know, maybe that's true of me, too, that that on the outside I'm grotesque, or we're all grotesque in some way. I mean, we're all not perfect here. But that you all feel as though you're Fred and Ginger sometimes. I mean, in moments of great happiness and great love, everybody feels wonderful.
When you were offered this role of Norman, what was it about it that appealed to you? Was it?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, the writing is wonderful. It's very funny. They said, come do this play. And I got the script. And the first thing you do if you're a real actor, let's talk turkey here, is you look at your lines and you say, well, does Norman appear frequently in the play? yes, by gosh, he does. And it's a terrific play. It really is. It's very well written. That's what I liked about it. I read the script and I thought it's good, and I thought it was easy. I thought, gee, Norman would be easy. And then I did it, and I thought, oops, it's not easy at all. It's very hard.
Why did you think Norman would be easy to do?
Because it was very well written. It seemed so simple. There's something about plays written, I think, by people who were actors. Shakespeare, for example, and Tom Griffin, who wrote this, and that the lines come from where they ought to come from. Sometimes non-actors or will write plays, and it's like their speeches suddenly. You know that a character would not say that, or even commercials sometimes. You know that whoever you're playing, it's not coming from deep inside. And I knew when I read The Boys Next Door that the lines in that play are coming from where the people are.
What's next for you?
Gee, I don't know. I have a 3-month contract with this. So I'll be there, of course, for the 3 months, and then I really don't know. I hope there's something out there waiting with my name on it. Again, you don't... At my present level of success, you don't call the shots. Columbia's not on the line saying, well, what do you think, Josh?
What would you call your level of success? I mean, where do you see yourself in the, success graph?
In the success graph? I think I'm pretty successful as an actor in the sense that the professionals in the business have seen my work. I think they assume that I can handle more than 4 lines in a row. People know who I am. I'm a successful actor. I support myself acting. And that's pretty good for actors. There's a lot of people that don't make a lot of money, don't make any money in our business, So if you can work a fairly constant, 2 or 3 things a year, I think you're doing pretty good. And that's, for the last few years, that's what I've been able to do. I've been able, for example, not to do commercials. In the last 5 years, I've gotten a number of movie parts, which pretty much have paid the bills.
And making the money in the movies then enables you to do something like The Boys Next Door,
yes.
Which
yeah.
You don't get paid a lot of money, but...
No. But, if you're an actor, you always kind of want to go back to the theater, because that's where it began. Long before there was movies, there was theater. And that's kind of... If you're an actor, that's kind of the primary thing.
Thank you, Josh Mostel, for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Film and stage actor Josh Mostel is appearing in the play The Boys Next Door at the Lambs Theater in New York. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who's co-hosting the program. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Leah.
What do you have for us today?
Well, we have coverage of the conclusion of the summit conference between President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. We'll be hearing about the meeting that Mr. Gorbachev went to after the formal farewell. He went to meet with a number of American business executives, presumably to talk about prospects for U.S.-Soviet trade. Also, the presentation of the Nobel Peace Prize to President Oscar Arias of Costa Rica. That's taking place today, and we'll hear about events in Central America. And also a piece by Bob Mondello on 3 new films, including the latest from Steven Spielberg and John Schlesinger.
Well, thank you very much, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our film critic, Stephen Schiff, has a review of the new Bernardo Bertolucci movie, The Last Emperor. The Italian director's earlier works include Last Tango in Paris, The Conformist, and 1900. For The Last Emperor, which he also co-wrote, Bertolucci spent 3 years in China researching the film before it went into production.
It used to be easier to make a big historical epic. In a more jingoistic era, American moviegoers were vaguely willing to believe that 20th century America was the culmination of everything that had gone before it. Pharaohs and Roman centurions and medieval crusaders all seemed to inhabit a world not terribly different from our own. They thought pretty much the way we do, and talked pretty much the way we do, and emoted pretty much the way we do. Well, we no longer live in a culture that accepts its own preeminence so unquestioningly. The strangely familiar monarchs and Huns of the old Hollywood movies now seem entertainingly corny. These days, if you're going to make an effective epic, you have a problem. How do you convey the strangeness of another place and another time, and still make a vast and complicated story comprehensible, all in less than 3 hours? I can't say that Bernardo Bertolucci has accomplished all this in The Last Emperor, but he's come close enough to make an exhilarating film. This is the true story of Puyi, the last emperor of the Qing dynasty, which was the last dynasty to rule in China before the revolution of 1911. The movie follows Puyi's life from the age of 3, when he was wrenched away from his mother to become emperor of China, through his imprisonment and re-education by the Red Chinese, and ends in 1967 when he died. In trying to cover so much ground, the movie sacrifices a certain intimacy with its main character. Whether he's played by the dashing John Lone or by any of 3 other actors, Puyi remains a passive, distant figure. We get close to him only briefly, as he develops a relationship with his English tutor, played by Peter O'Toole, and then prepares to marry.
But who did you choose to be the Empress?
They chose her. She's very old, Johnston. She's 17.
It's not so old, Your Majesty. What does she look like?
Old-fashioned. I want a modern wife, Johnston, who speaks English and French, and who can dance the quick step.
Bertolucci has always been a Marxist director, but paradoxically, he's always been most attracted to the lush and decadent trappings of power. And so, in The Last Emperor, he fudges what seems to be his main point, that Puyi, trapped within the walls of Peking's forbidden city, and hence within the walls of his position and power, finally finds freedom in the humble life of a gardener. Bertolucci doesn't seem much interested in Puyi's transformation. What fascinates him is the pageantry of Imperial China, and The Last Emperor fills your eyes and ears with it. Bertolucci filmed most of it on location, and the sense of color and space and mystery he brings to the screen is purely and spectacularly Chinese, irreproducible anywhere else. The real power of the movie lies underneath its storyline, in the disturbing eroticism of Bertolucci's imagery. Puyi's story is a tale of power and impotency, of a boy who commands half the world and yet cannot ever have what he desires most, his mother's loving presence. For Puyi, China itself becomes his adoring mother, and later, during his imprisonment, a stern, reproving father. Bertolucci's symbols form a delicate filigree that runs through the larger spectacle. When you see the movie, watch for the patterns of blindness and seeing, of walls and imprisonment, and watch above all for the way the women in Puyi's life run in contrasting pairs. It's screen imagery, not character, that fleshes out Bertolucci's version of history. The Last Emperor isn't quite a great film, but it's a stunning one. It's that rarity, a historical epic with real sensuality, real wonder, and real cinematic flair.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at our next show. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with guitarist Rai Cooter. He's just released his 11th record album, Get Rhythm, and has composed several film scores, including Paris, Texas. We'll hear from Adrienne Kennedy on what led her to become a playwright, and critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss the magic and comedy of Penn and Teller. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of Philadelphia's business and cultural district.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.